and there was a knock on the door. A young guy wanted to have his music heard. It was Bruce Springsteen. He played about four songs for us, and we quit our jobs the next morning and decided to manage Bruce. It was that obvious.
That is the voice of Bob Spitz, who, as you may have inferred, was one of the original managers of Bruce Springsteen. How cool would that have been to be there at the start, or at least at the start from a managerial standpoint, of the boss? Welcome to Rob Bob Radio's Rock Conversations. I am Rob Bob, the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll music. And in just a few minutes, we will pick up on our discussion with Bob Spitz, an incredibly interesting conversation, because Bob Spitz is an incredibly interesting person. He started, or at least one of his careers involved managing Bruce Springsteen. But then he became and is currently a well-known author. Listen to some of the topics he's covered in his books: President Reagan, The Beatles, Julia Child, and Woodstock. And then this fall, he will release a brand new book about a very, very well-known band from Great Britain. Now, I'm not going to tell you the subject of his book yet. That's what we call in the business a little tease to keep you intrigued, to keep you guessing. But I will say the band formed in the late 1960s and put out a number of great albums, at least three of which were numbered, and some would say the fourth was numbered as well. Or maybe it was Symbols. Maybe it was just symbolic. Anyway, we will talk with Bob Spitz in just a couple of minutes. One of the things I learned, and I, as the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll, I consider myself a pretty big fan of Bruce Springsteen and think I know a lot about him. Now, in reality, there is a lot I don't know. And one of the things I did not know that Bob Spitz will talk about is that early on in Bruce's career, there was a duo from Philadelphia that opened for Bruce in New York City, I think he says. That duo was Hall & Oates. Can you imagine that? Hall & Oates opening for Bruce Springsteen. Well, for reasons that Bob will explain, it did not last too long, and the next opening act was even more intriguing. But anytime I hear of Hall & Oates, I always think back to this story. I was growing up in Winona, Minnesota. It was summer, I think, of 1983, probably the H2O tour for Hall & Oates. And my dad was a CPA, owned his own business, went to work early in the morning, and he would have on in the background in his office the local FM station, KG95 from Winona. They were a client of his, and, you know, it was easy listening or semi-pop music, so it wasn't distracting either to him or to his clients who came in later in the day. But early that morning, they ran some trivia contest, and he listened, and he knew the answer, but he wasn't going to call. It just wasn't his style, and he certainly really didn't want to be the one calling a station that happens to be a client of his. Well, after two or three attempts and not getting the right answer, finally my dad called. I think it was, you know, Who Died with the Big Bopper and others, and it was Buddy Holly, of course, in the plane crash leaving Iowa. So he calls home, talks to my mom. My mom comes in, wakes me up, you know, pounds on the door. Here I am, a high school student sleeping late in the summer, thinking, Mom, what are you doing bothering me? And she said, guess what? Dad just won some tickets for a concert tonight in La Crosse. La Crosse, Wisconsin, is about a half hour from Winona, just down Highway 61 along the river. I said, oh, yeah, who? Hollow Oates. I said, Hollow Oates? She says, yeah, Hollow Oates. Have you ever heard of them? I said, Mom, I think you mean Hall and Oates. So anytime I hear about Hall and Oates, I think of my mom and Hollow Oates. That show was great. The three of us went. We bought an extra ticket. And Bob Spitz, he'll talk a little bit about Hall & Oates, probably not Hollow Oates. So with that said, let's get to our rock conversation with Bob Spitz.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
We on this program often talk to writers who have been close to rock and roll musicians. We've talked to DJs who've interviewed rock and roll musicians, but we have yet to talk to an author who actually managed rock and roll musicians. And that's what we have today with Bob Spitz. It's great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob. Great to be here.
Let's go back in your career and discuss one of my favorite artists, Bruce Springsteen. How did you ever hook up with him?
Well, it's a great story, actually. I left home right after college and moved to New York. And got a job I was lucky with a guy who was producing rock and roll artists. Actually, I won't even say rock and roll, it was pop artists. He produced David Cassidy, Tony Orlando and Don, people like that. I was in the office late one night after it had closed with two other guys who were much older than I and writing music there. And there was a knock on the door. A young guy wanted to have his music heard. It was Bruce Springsteen. He played about four songs for us, which I was smart enough to record. And we quit our jobs the next morning and decided to manage Bruce. It was that obvious. Not only that, we had a deal for him at Columbia Records within 4 days. That's how quickly everything happened.
That's amazing. Do you remember the four songs? Were they from what turned out to be his first album?
Yeah, he did Saint in the City. He did If I Was the Priest, which actually he's just recorded now on his new album after all these years, after 40 years. And a song called No Need, which I thought was one of his best he's never recorded. And I forget the fourth one, but we were cutting glasses at each other while he was singing. He just sat in the waiting room and sang on a really ratty guitar. It was an epiphany.
Now those early years weren't necessarily easy for Bruce, like it is for many artists. You kind of need that breakthrough album. And I'm not sure the sales were there with the first two initially. How did you help guide him what was your role? Were you considered manager, co-manager?
I was considered a co-manager with my two partners. And I played with Bruce occasionally as well, either guitar or piano. It was easier than you think for Bruce. I mean, the hard part was being on the road 4 or 5 nights a week. And it wasn't a tour that was set up with any brains that we had. We would play, say, Philadelphia, and then the next night we would drive out to Champaign, Illinois. And the night after that, we'd be in Boston. We drove everywhere. We had station wagons. But Bruce was a trooper. I mean, this is a guy who the only thing he wanted to do was to perform. He wanted to be in front of an audience. And he knew how to do it. He had done it in his head all of his life, and he was ready to roll it out. So he was the least of our worries. Bruce was always there, always ready to perform.
You mentioned Boston. For whatever reason, I recall Boston was very Bruce friendly, almost from day one. And WBCN, I think, was one of the earlier radio stations to really gravitate toward playing Bruce music. What was it about that connection?
Yeah, it was three cities. It was Boston, it was Cleveland, and it was Philadelphia. They were cities that we could reach by car. So they knew him. We were there often. We went into the radio stations and they heard it right away. You know, it was a great time for radio. It was only about 5 years after FM, progressive radio, really established itself. And they were, the DJs were young, still kind of, you know, fresh out of college, and really plugged into the music scene. A lot of them were musicians themselves. So they were open to a guy like Bruce. They had as good ears as we had, and they could tell right away what we could tell the minute we had heard Bruce play for us. So, it rolled out in those cities, I guess, a little faster than elsewhere.
Bob Spitz is our guest. He's written, we're talking about his managing days, but he is an author. He's written books about such notables as the Beatles, a forthcoming book on Led Zeppelin. We're going to get to the discussion on the books in a little bit, but I'm so intrigued, mostly as a fan of both Bruce and radio. You mentioned Cleveland, WMMS and Kid Leo were big supporters. What was Kid Leo like when you dealt with him?
Well, just, you know, I mean, these were people who became fans. We invited these people out to see Bruce in the clubs. And the minute they got their eyes on him, they laid their eyes on him, they were sold. He was such an electric performer. And in those days, Bruce would come out by himself first just on acoustic guitar. Occasionally, I backed him on acoustic guitar. And he would tell stories. I mean, we used to have to say to him, Bruce, you have to sing a little, you know, which he did. But he would tell great stories that were funny, and he was witty. He was really like a Mark Twain character. And these DJs, like Kid Leo and I'm forgetting the person in Philadelphia, and of course, you know, Scott Muni and Pete Fornatel and Dennis Elsis in New York, big fans of Bruce, J.J. Jackson in Boston, they were sold right away. They became huge fans. They would call us, and we would make sure we serviced them right away when any new album came out or if we had a tape of Bruce doing something. It was easier than you think.
Now, this, I'm not sure if this was during your time managing or came after, but I recall hearing a story that the late NBC News anchor Tim Russert actually booked Bruce shows when he was at John Carroll. Is that true in Cleveland?
We played John Carroll, but if Tim booked the shows, I do not know it.
Could have been later. It could have been later in Bruce's career. Now, final Bruce question.
Yeah.
I think I promise. There may be more. Do you have a favorite album from your time with Bruce? I realize it's probably an unfair question. It's like asking someone to pick a, you know, favorite child or something like that. But I'll ask it anyway and let you answer.
Well, my time with Bruce was really short as far as albums were concerned. It was, you know, it was Greetings from Asbury Park and the E Street Shuffle. And so those albums still remain my favorites because, you know, they were dear to my heart. And I really believe that those were the essence of early Bruce Springsteen. But I'll tell you a great Bruce Springsteen story that I'm sure people will love to hear and that they don't know. We, in 1972, we played Max's Kansas City for 2 weeks. The opening act was Hall & Oates. Their first album was just out. And after the first week, Tommy Mottola, who was their manager, came to us and said, you know, you guys are great. We're great, but you're blowing us off the stage. This isn't a good pairing for us. And you can imagine, Max's Kansas City was a room probably as big as your living room. And to have both of those bands on the stage there in that room was just remarkable. So he asked if they could leave after the first week. And I said, sure, you know, it's up to you. I mean, if you want to leave. But it was up to me to book a second act, to open the bill for us for the second week. And I got a call from a friend of mine at Island Records who said, look, I've got to get a band on somewhere in New York, and I will lose my job if I can't get them some work. And I said, you got them. I didn't know who they were. It didn't matter. He didn't send a record over. So Max's weeks lasted from Sunday night to Sunday night. And that Sunday night, when Hall & Oates had left and we had the new act on, around 6 o'clock, we did 3 shows a night. An audience started to come up that I had never seen before. And it was, they were all black and they had long dreadlocks. And we were kind of like, well, what's going on here? They're not our audience. We don't know how they showed up. This was the first performance ever in America of Bob Marley and the Wailers, and they opened for Bruce Springsteen for six nights, 3 nights, 3 shows a night. You can imagine the music that was on that. And this was the original Wailers with the I-3 and Bunny and the whole gang. First of all, we had never seen spliffs like that. It was amazing what they were doing. We had never heard reggae before, so we didn't understand the beat. We stood at the side of the stage for the first few shows. We couldn't count the beat. It was just remarkable. But you can imagine what a week of music that was in New York for Bob Marley and the Wailers, Bruce Springsteen, 3 shows a night.
I don't know what amazes me more, the fact that, you know, the pairing of Bob Marley and Bruce Springsteen, or 3 shows a night for 6 nights in a row. Right. I mean, that's some intense performing.
Well, we'd start at 8 o'clock at night. We'd do a 10 o'clock show. We'd do a midnight show. And we were basically going home at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. It was a lot of hard work. But it was great. And that's what we're missing today. That kind of the kind of outlets that young bands have to get out there and perform and work that hard and really work out all the kinks in their show before they do an arena show.
We are talking with Bob Spitz, who's had a remarkable career. We'll get into some of the books that he's written and talk about them in just a matter of a couple minutes. But keeping with the managerial phase of your career, let's talk about Sir Elton John. How did you encounter and hook up and work with him?
Really odd. I left Bruce after a couple of years, after 4.5, 5 years. There were some funny things going on with my managers, my co-managers, which resulted in a lawsuit between Bruce and
them. I was going to say that didn't go too well in the big picture. It took a little time.
It didn't, but I knew things weren't going well early, and I went to Bruce and I said, a lot of your money's missing. And Bruce was, he had just been on the cover of Time and Newsweek the same week, and he did not want to hear it. And I said, well, I can't stick around in this anymore. I've got to leave. I can't be part of it. And I left. I had no job whatsoever. I was young. I was about 25 years old. I had just gotten married. And a woman who had worked for the guy who had hired me, the music publisher, called and said, listen, I've got a new job and I'm with a really interesting guy and he needs somebody to manage him in North America. And I said, who is it? And she said, Elton John. And I almost fell over because Elton was, he was just rolling out Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. It was number one in all the charts. And I was in over my head. I mean, I was not the person to do this. She said, you definitely are. I've told them about you. Went over and met them. And they hired me. And so I represented Elton in North America for 2 years while he did Yellow Brick Road, Caribou, and Rock of the Westies. And it was exciting. I went from representing a guy who traveled in station wagons and we ate Cheetos and McDonald's food to a guy who told me that he had his own private plane. There were 110 people on the road and we stayed in the best hotels and ate at the finest restaurants. It was a revelation to me.
Well, it was, I imagine from stories I've read, stories I've seen in documentaries, that this was for Elton John, and I'm guessing hopefully for those around him, kind of an era of decadence, as you just alluded to. I think he was enjoying, shall we say, the spoils of being a rock and roll superstar. He's admittedly, I think, been a bit of a prima donna. And I can't imagine, I'm sure you can, clarify for us a little with some stories, but what was it like to have to manage him, to literally kind of, you know, deal with all his wants and needs on a 24/7 basis?
You know, I'm going to burst your bubble with this one, Rob. Elton was not into decadence at all at this time. The biggest problem that he had during this time was whether to admit that he was gay. And he outed himself in Rolling Stone while I was with them during that time. It was a very big thing for him. But the truth of the matter is, he was such a gentleman, such an incredibly easy person to manage, so sure of what he was doing in his career. And he had John Reed, who was his road manager at the time, who later became his manager, who really knew what to do on the road with everybody. So I had the easiest job in the world. And I have to say that Elton was a gentleman the whole time. It was lovely to work for him.
That's cool to hear. Yeah, especially, yeah. You know, when we've heard other stories. When you talk about his coming out in Rolling Stone, is that something that he had discussed with you prior and sought, advice? Because this, especially back then, obviously was not an easy thing to do. And it could have put his career at jeopardy in some people's minds.
Right. Oh, no. He wrestled with it for a long time. I mean, he didn't know what to do. And I'm sure it was a struggle for him. But he didn't really discuss it with anybody. He just decided to do it. He thought the time was right. He felt it was right for him. Actually, it was one of the most seamless and effortless things once he did come out in Rolling Stone. Everybody embraced him for it, and he became kind of, a standard bearer for the LGBT community. It was great. It was, I think, a wonderful period and very instructive in his life.
One final question on Elton and that coming out. Did you sense a change in his attitude? Was there some relief, a burden off his shoulders after he came out?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he just put that entire thing that he'd been struggling with aside, and he just became himself, and it allowed him to concentrate on his music and his career in a much more direct and forthright way.
Let's switch gears here. I keep alluding to the fact that you've written books, which you have. You've been gracious enough to share some stories from your days as a rock and roll manager, which are fascinating. The books, among others, include The Beatles, Julia Child, Ronald Reagan, and coming up later this year, Led Zeppelin. I'm glad you really pick figures who are not too well known.
Yeah, right. And also who made a lot of sense if you draw a straight line through them, of course. The Beatles, the Julia Child, to Ronald Reagan makes complete sense.
Oh, of course. In all seriousness, I mean, you writers like you who take on these tasks of writing a book about, in the Beatles' case, a group, in Julia Child's and Ronald Reagan's case, an individual, about whom a lot has already been written and about whom a lot people already know. How do you go about it to make sure the book is unique, fresh, and not just rehashing, I shouldn't say rehashing, but not, you know, some of the same old stories that people have read elsewhere? I would think that would be a very exciting and daunting challenge simultaneously.
Yeah, listen, the reason I've done it is because I've chosen these subjects because I felt these subjects had been written about endlessly. I mean, in the Beatles case, there had been 800 books written on them when I decided to do that story. But in each case, I realized that the writers had never done the homework. I mean, they had never done the research. They had never talked to everybody who was involved with these people and exhausted the research. And I felt that they really deserved They deserved really definitive biographies. With the Beatles, and this kind of is the way I established my career, Paul McCartney had said to me during an interview that I did with him for the New York Times, we did a book with Hunter Davies in the early 60s, in which we made up about 50% of our story to protect our wives, girlfriends, families from the grittier truth. And he said, we've told that story for 40 years, and I don't think any of us know which is true or not true anymore. Well, my eyes lit up, and I thought, the Beatles? I mean, they have not had a story that's accurate. It's all based on these interviews that the Beatles had given when they were kids. So I said, look, I'm going to set the story straight. And I went to talk to Michael Peach, who was the publisher of Little Brown. And I said, there have been 800 books on the Beatles. He said, yeah, but this is going to be the one where we take everything and we synthesize it. We make sure what's right. And you're going to do the legwork. And so nobody had ever talked to all of John's and Paul's boyhood friends, the woman who raised Ringo, the friends and all the bands from Liverpool and starting up, the guys they played with in school, all the people they had been on tour with. There's so much of a supporting cast to these big figures that I've written about that have never really told people what really happened around the fringes of these live stories. So, you know, the Beatles knew what they were doing on stage and when they talked to Brian Epstein, but they didn't know what was going on all around them with the people that they touched. There's always a bigger story involved, and this is the way I set out to do things. I do not talk to the main figures in my book until I've exhausted talking to everyone else. And so by the time I get to the main figures, in the case of the Beatles, it was Paul and George, they were astounded by what I had learned. They had never heard it before. I mean, Paul learned things about his mother's death that he told me when he read them, he burst into tears. He had no idea that that was going on at the time, because I had talked to his aunt and I had talked to his cousins who were with her at the time while he was on the road. So, you know, there's always a larger story to be written if you do your homework and you know, you do a definitive book. And that's what I hope to have done in every case here.
I did an interview a while back with Sylvie Simmons, longtime rock critic, and she's done some books. And she told me about one book. You know, she's well known for her book on Leonard Cohen. She said, I asked her, you know, do you have a wish list? And one of the two subjects she would like to feature is Tom Waits. But he hasn't really agreed to cooperate. And her concern is that there, if she started a project like this, there would be roadblocks, that somehow Tom might pick up the phone, call his friends and say, you know, don't talk to her. Did you ever encounter anything like that with the Beatles? Did they ever try to put the kibosh on certain people talking to you?
No. And I think one of the reasons they didn't is because I had spent a lot of time with Paul early on doing that New York Times piece. And we related not just as a writer to this artist, but he knew that I was a musician. And so when we talked, he understood. I understood what he was saying. He understood what I was saying. We communicated on a different level. And I think I gave him a measure of comfort that he never had before with other writers, and was willing to open up. I mean, the thing that I always found when I was researching the Beatles story was his friends and his family and everyone who was close said, listen, we're not allowed to talk. For 40 years, there's been a gag order on. If you talk, you're out of the circle. And I'd say, well, call Paul or call George. And they'd call me back and they'd say, God, they said to talk to you. I mean, we've never told these stories before. They were dying to get them out. And the book that you know that I've written is 964 pages. But when I turned the manuscript in, it was 2,800 pages.
Oh, my.
I had so much material. My editor called and said, listen, we've done a little cut here. I said, what's a little cut? He said, well, we've cut out 1,100 pages. I said, incredible. And then after they did the first cut, he said, now we're going to make you cry. Now we're going to cut another 600 pages out of the book. We let a lot of great stories go, but I think we got the best one going.
So I asked you an unfair question earlier to pick your favorite Springsteen album. I'm going to ask you another unfair question. If we could look at just, let's look at the four books we've mentioned. You know, the Beatles, Reagan, Julia Child, and Zeppelin. What surprised you most, or what was one of the most surprising things you found in researching each of those four subjects?
Okay. That's not what I thought you were going to ask me. I thought you were going to ask me what my favorite Beatles album is.
Well, I can ask you that right now. I would say mine, not that you're asking me, but I'll tell you, I always seem to come back to Revolver, but Pepper and the White Album, for some reason, are real close, as is Rubber Soul.
Well, you and I are thinking on the same wavelength. Revolver, to me, changed the course of music. I think it's the exact pivotal point where rock and roll becomes rock music. When you drop the needle, the needle on that album, and you hear George cough and they launch into Taxman, that is something that no person who listened to rock and roll had ever heard before. It was so different. Not only was the approach to it, the cough and the offhanded manner, but the sound that they made, I believe, changed rock and roll right there.
Not to mention the FU to the government.
Exactly right. I mean, that whole album changed every young kid's head at that point. But I agree with you. For me, the canon of the Beatles is Revolver, Rubber Soul, White Album. It's all there. Sgt. Pepper's, to me, is the most overrated album.
I still like Pepper. I don't know if I'd call it the most overrated, but it's not at the Revolver level. You know, it's interesting. My younger son is a music performance major in college. He plays French horn. And for whatever reason, I'll blame this on my dad duties, right? I've exposed my boys to a lot of music, largely rock and roll, but apparently I'd left off the song For No One with that great French horn solo. And I sent it to him. I said, Patrick, you got to learn how to play it. He said, it's a little out of his range right now. I said, well, keep working on it. And I remember the day, strangely, I was riding the South Shore Railroad between South Bend, Indiana, to visit my grandma in Northern Indiana. And I'm reading the New York Times, and there was the obit for the French horn player. He was well known for all this classical music he had performed, but there in big bold print in the bit, in the obit, was played with the Beatles on Revolver.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wonder how it sticks. Okay, now back to the other unfair questions.
Yes.
The surprising one of the most surprising aspects of researching each of those four figures we mentioned.
Yeah, well, with the Beatles, it was how hard they worked. I was shocked by the degree of effort they put into their career, not only their songwriting, but the overall way they thought about things. Just blew me away. They were businessmen, Paul and John especially, and the way the two men communicated, you know, it was a symbiotic relationship. That relationship astounded me. The Julia Child story, oh boy, same thing. I mean, you know, Julia changed not only the way we eat, but the way we live. She reconfigured supermarkets in America as we know it. They never had cheese departments before she got involved. They never had the selection of groceries before she got involved. And we had no wine industry in America before Julia really got involved and threaded all these little stores together and developed the American wine industry. She was, to me, one of the most important women of the 20th century. Ronald Reagan, oh man, Ronald Reagan, I've never voted for a Republican in my life. And there I was as Ronald Reagan's biographer. and I remember specifically voting against him twice. But I found a man in that story who was a remarkable human being that had distinguished himself in four different careers. He began as the voice of the Midwest on the radio. He was a prolific sports announcer. He was a movie star and the governor and the president of the United States. The story transfixed me, and Nancy allowed me, God knows why, to be the only person who ever had access to his private papers. These are not the papers that are in the Reagan Library. These, although they are there, but they were the ones that he kept in his personal files next to his desk. And when I got to them, they had not been unpacked since he left the White House. So I was the first person.
And were these handwritten?
They were. They were annotated by him, magazine articles that he had found, things he loved about America were handwritten and annotated. I could really understand why he went in the directions that he did so often. And while I disagreed with his politics and still disagree with his politics, I encountered a man who loved America in a way that really turned my head around. And he always did things from his heart for the best possible reasons. And that was something that, you know, completely floored me.
I think that's we're talking with Bob Spitz, by the way, author of many books, including a biography on Ronald Reagan. But I think you summed it up best that, you know, he was a true American. And I do think, unlike other politicians, elected officials, he did what he thought was right at that time. Not everyone can say that. Did you think he was a better governor than president or vice versa?
I thought he was a good governor, but he was in way over his head and really didn't know how to govern during that time. He really came to his own while he was president. And what he did more than anything was he surrounded himself with really good people. He had very, very capable assistance from Howard, Jim Baker and Howard Baker, right on through. And the way really that I came to this story and got so many people to open up and talk to me was, I went first to his fourth chief of staff, a guy named Ken Duberstein. You may or may not know who he was.
I do.
Ken Duberstein was my camp counselor when I was a kid. And I had not seen him in 45 years. So I went to see him first. And, you know, he was floored just to see who I was. Of course, I was floored to see who he was. And he opened up the whole universe to me. And so that allowed me to get behind the scenes. It allowed people to trust me. And once I started talking to people like, you know, Ed Meese, who never talked to anybody, or Robert McFarland, Bud McFarland, who was his intelligence officer, they felt that my approach was a good one. In Meese's case, he spent 80 hours with me. In McFarland's case, he spent over 120 hours with me. And so I really covered this in a way that nobody had before.
I think I only have one Reagan story, but I'd like to share it with you if you'll indulge me and our listeners as well. So I was I thought this kind of epitomized Reagan. I had never voted for him. In fact, I think I was too young to vote both times he ran for president. But he was in 1987, late 87 or early 88. I can't remember. I was a freshman at Notre Dame, and he came to unveil the new Newt Rockne stamp. Right. Dieter Phelps, the basketball coach at the time, was a big stamp collector, and they had worked together. And I thought it epitomized Reagan because here he was on stage, literally, as president, but there was still kind of that Hollywood aura to him, that showbiz aura as he's unveiling this stamp. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, I was working for the college radio station at the time, and, you know, things were much looser, so much looser back then. We had security, but it was very minimal. So I got on the dais in the back, and we're standing there, and he gets to the speech, and he's talking about, you know, how he played George Gipp, right? Mm-hmm. And he says, he gets into the famous speech, and, you know, when the things are down, Rock, you know, tell him, go out, win one for the – and he said that day, he said, win one for the Gippet. And I'm like, did he just say that? Not Gipper, Gippet? And sure enough, it might have been the onset, or maybe he was in the throes of some of his dementia or Alzheimer's. We didn't realize it. The other thing I remember from that day is, you know, I drove out to the airport, took some back roads, got right onto the tarmac. You know, here's this little punk freshman at the college radio station. I'm able to get on the tarmac. Limo shows up, Digger's with him. He's got a signed ball that Reagan goes up the stairs of Air Force One, has the basketball in his hand, waves to the crowd. Whatever little crowd there was, you know, we didn't have that many, and gets on. And forever that will be etched in my mind. And then I went over and interviewed Chris Wallace afterwards, who was working for NBC at the time. So thank you for indulging me with my story. This is your time. But I mean, it was really a fascinating afternoon that clearly Reagan, I haven't forgotten.
Reagan was always the performer, even when he was president, even when he was governor. He loved to perform. And so every speech he gave, every personal appearance he made, There was a lot of performance in it, and he always came prepared with an opening, and the opening was usually, you know, something that would end in a laugh. He knew how to do it, and I came to really admire the guy while writing it. It was a book that everybody warned me not to write. My Democratic friends said that, you know, it was heresy for me to do it. And my Republican friends, and believe me, I have some Republican friends. Both of my Republican friends told me.
Both of them. Nice, nice.
Right,
okay.
Exactly.
I want to be respectful of your time. So if we could just go through a few more questions, if that's okay. I want to backtrack to Julia Child.
Absolutely.
My wife and I were listening to an interview that you did. And I have to confess, it had nothing to do with the interview. It's just that it was late at night. I fell asleep. So my wife said today, are you going to ask him about this? I said, well, I think I was sleeping. And she said that you were sent to pick up this lady and you had no clue who she was.
It's not quite the way it came out. Here's the story.
Okay.
I was in Italy. I was working as a journalist during those days. And I was in Italy and I had about six articles I was writing for various magazines. And I got a call from a friend of mine at the Italian Tourist Board who said, we know you have some extra time while you're in Italy, and we wondered if you would consider being an escort for an older woman. And I said, buddy, I don't do that kind of work. And he said, it's Julia Child. And I said, I'll be right over. As it turned out, Julia was in Italy. She was going to spend a couple weeks there, like 3 weeks, just eating food and going to restaurants and getting around. She was 80 years old and her legs were not great. And she needed a young arm to hold on to. And I was a young arm. I was in my early 40s. And so we hit it off right away. And I got to spend maybe 2.5 weeks with Julia, doing nothing but eating 3 meals a day with her and talking. And I recorded them. And I fell in love. I mean, you know, she was an amazing woman. She was, she did not mince words. She was a great eater and a great drinker. She drank me under the table every night.
I'm impressed.
They had to carry me out. Julia was ready to have another meal and another 2 bottles of wine. And she knew her stuff. And I said to her, you know, one day I'm going to write your biography. And she encouraged me, but I began work on the Beatles. And by the time the Beatles was finished, Julia had passed on. But I got complete cooperation from her family and all of her friends. And it was one of my favorite books. It was, I don't even remember writing that book. I spent 4 years on it. It seems like I wrote that book in 2 weeks. It just poured right out of me. It was very easy to write.
Now, before we move ahead to Led Zeppelin, by the way, we're talking with Bob Spitz in our waning moments. I don't want to forget, you mentioned off the air that there's going to be a documentary on Julia Child based largely on your book. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, it's actually finished. It'll be out this summer if there are theaters ever again in America. It's directed by Betsy West and Julie Cohen, who directed RBG last year. And they did a wonderful job with that. And I have not seen the movie yet. My book was called Deary, the biography of Julia, but the movie will just be called Julia. So it'll be in theaters. It's a Sony Classics Picture movie. And CNN bought the broadcasting rights to it after it's done with theaters. So it's going to have a long shelf life. And I'm really excited.
I presume we'll see you interviewed a few times, I hope.
I assume so. Yeah, I guess so. I haven't seen the cut, so I don't know.
Hopefully it doesn't end up with those 1,200 pages or 1,400 pages of the Beatles book.
Right, exactly.
That would be good.
Now, before we get to Led Zeppelin, I should tell you there's another book in between that you've missed, and that it's a book you don't know about. I ghost wrote Graham Nash's memoir, Wild Tales, and that was in between Ronald Reagan and Led Zeppelin, and that was a great story as well.
Graham always strikes me, if you don't mind talking about him real quickly. Again, and I'm drawing these conclusions on the music I hear, the stories I hear, things like that. But Graham always seemed to be kind of the rooted one of CSNNY. And the others were always having their either external or internal issues, and he seemed a little grounded. Is that the case?
Definitely the case. I think that it was Graham who really kept that together. And also his love at the time of David Crosby. They had a relationship much like John and Paul had. They were joined at the hip. They really cared deeply about each other. And I think it's one of the things that's troubling Graham and David the most now is that they're not speaking. They've had a falling out, chiefly because of the book.
Unfortunately, did you see the documentary on David Crosby?
I did, yeah, without a doubt.
I was telling someone about this the other day, comparing that to Echo in the Canyon. Echo in the Canyon, I think, features a very ebullient and funny David Crosby at times when he's interviewed. The one about him, the title's escaping me. Is it Remember My Name or something like that?
Exactly.
And it's almost a tragedy. Here's all this talent that has lost all of his friends, it seems. And it also appeared that no one really wanted to speak on the record for that film, and maybe for good reason.
Yeah, it's even more of a tragedy because he is the intellect of that group. He is a witty guy. He's smart as a whip. He's got a gorgeous voice. David's got his problems, and they've followed him throughout his entire career. It's part of the thing that makes him so interesting as well. But I think that both he and Graham right now really are in the grieving part of their relationship, that it's not together and that they're estranged.
You'd almost like to shake them and say, come on, guys, you don't have much left on this earth. Let's find a way. Let's get together. Even if you're not making music, at least be friends.
Yeah, they have a 50th anniversary coming up, and it doesn't look like they're going to do anything for it, which is a shame. So.
That is. Yeah. All right. I've taken a lot of your time, so we can be as short or as long as you want here, talking about the forthcoming book on Led Zeppelin. Here we have another group that's been written about extensively, whether in books or publications. What fascinated you or what surprised you when you did your research for this book on Zeppelin?
Well, let me first tell you why I came to it. I have 10,000 albums at home. I don't have a single Led Zeppelin album.
Really?
And had you asked me to name their songs, I probably only could have named Whole Lotta Love and Stairway to Heaven. I knew nothing about them. In fact, when my editor told me that this was a book he absolutely wanted me to write and that it was near and dear to his heart, my heart sunk. I had nothing to bring to the story. Little did I realize it turned out to be a fantastic story. It really begins with Jimmy Page and the birth of the blues, going back to the Yardbirds and the Stones in the UK, and even before that, and following Jimmy's career all the way up with Jeff Beck, and the whole synthesis of blues into rock and roll, the Truth album, which Beck's album I hold right up there with Revolver, as changing the sound of music as we know it today. And then the incredible story of Led Zeppelin and how they changed the sound of music and really the end of the 60s, the beginning of the 70s. It's right there. I kind of loved this story. I loved writing it. I found out, shockingly, that the books that had been written about them were of two kinds. Number one, either a Hammer of the Gods type story that rolls out all the sleaze and only cares about the sleaze, or stories written by, and I hate to say it, British trade paper hacks, guys who knew how to ask them, you know, who their girlfriends were and what guitar strings they used, but really never got into what really motivated them or couldn't really analyze their music. There's no book about Led Zeppelin that puts you right there while they're recording their songs and lets you understand how they not only put it together, but what the music means. And I could bring that to the story as a musician. I understood it right away. So I really found a new way of expressing myself and learning this incredible trove of music that I had never heard before. I came to appreciate it, just like I came to appreciate Ronald Reagan.
I had two pretty interesting conversations for this podcast in recent weeks that dealt in part with Zeppelin. One was with Barney Hoskins, who's written about them. And what I asked him, I said, was Jimmy Page the driving force generally behind the band? And I want to compare what he said or get your thoughts on what you think on what he said, if that's not too convoluted. I think we'll get to it. So he basically said Page was the driving force behind the band until he was a little overcome with substance use. And then Plant kind of took the helm and said, all right, we're going to guide this thing and put this ship in the right direction, even if Jimmy is struggling a little. Is that what you found in your research?
Absolutely. Barney's right on the money. And let me begin by telling you that nobody contributed more to this book than Barney Hoskins, to my book. He has one of the greatest resources for any writer or any rock fan around. It's called rocksbackpages.com. And it is the greatest resource of rock and roll. And I tapped into it repeatedly for this book. It really brings together in one place every article ever written about rock and roll bands. It's all there. And not only that, Barney wrote a really fantastic book in the UK called Trampled Underfoot. Here it was called Led Zeppelin, which is an oral history of the band. And Barney put me in touch with all these people, and I could really get them to flesh out their stories. And they, in turn, put me in touch with everybody else who was critical to this story. Getting back to your original question, Barney's right on the money. This was Jimmy Page's band. He put them together in a much the same way that the Monkees were put together. I mean, you know, he chose one from column A, one from column B, artists that he had never heard before, and put together his dream band.
It's kind of funny. I don't think I've ever thought of Zeppelin and the Monkees in the same comparison, but you're spot on. There's no doubt about it. Another conversation I had recently was with a former Chicago DJ, Bobby Skafish, and he interviewed on separate occasions both Jimmy Page, back when Page was still enjoying his cocktails. I guess he came in with, you know, one of those 1.75 liter of vodka with the handle so he could mix it. What did Bobby Skafish say? Atomic strength screwdrivers. Uh-huh. Little orange juice and the rest vodka. And he also interviewed Plant, and the big questions, even though they were kind of off limits, I guess, is when Zeppelin going to reunite? When Zeppelin getting back together? When are we going to see Zeppelin again? I think my memory is kind of tarnished in that I didn't see all Zeppelin's reunions, if you will. And unfortunately, the one that sticks out for me is the Live Aid show, which I thought was terrible. Is Zeppelin a band that maybe was better left back in the 80s when they split?
Yeah, I think that they were pretty smart to a certain extent to do what the Beatles had done. And that is, once you disband, leave it alone. Don't get back together. And really, they only got together for three momentous occasions after the fact, when they used Jason Bonham. Right. So first Phil Collins as the drummer, and then Jason Bonham. But they did it for Live Aid. They did it for a tribute to Ahmet Erdogan. And
That's right. Atlantic Records, right?
And then they did and then they did another Atlantic Records thing at the O2. But I think they knew not to do it again. And the person who never wanted to perform again with them was Robert. Robert seriously wanted to have his career away from them. John Paul desperately wanted to get Led Zeppelin back together, and he implored Robert over and over again to consider it. But Robert was having none of it. Jimmy too. Jimmy's whole life is Led Zeppelin. I mean, Jimmy tried several other bands, but for the last 25 years, he's dedicated himself to reissues, keeping the whole Led Zeppelin legacy alive. It became his life. Robert wasn't up for it and didn't want to do it. And truthfully, Robert never wanted to sing Stairway to Heaven again as long as he was alive. My wife would be happy if he kept that promise.
And to be fair, as you say, Robert wanted to set himself apart from the band, and he did very well. You know, the first solo album was almost like a Zeppelin reboot. But once he got past that, I thought he created a slightly different sound, more than slightly different sound, and a very enjoyable sound with, you know, a number of songs that got some, back when, you know, there was radio, got some radio airplay.
Yeah, I saw him about 2 years ago with a band of young kids in New York at a little theater. And it was kick-ass rock and roll. I mean, it was really some inventive stuff. I was incredibly impressed. So he was still on the money as far as exploring what he could do with his talent.
Well, Bob Spitz, this has been a wonderful conversation. Tell us when the Zeppelin book is coming out. When should we look for it on the bookshelves and on Amazon and elsewhere?
It's coming out on a historic day, November 8th, 2021. It is the 50th anniversary of Stairway to Heaven.
And it will also be the second anniversary for my wife and me.
Aha, uh-huh. There you go.
I said, you know, when we decided on November 8th, I looked it up. I said, there's got to be something significant that happened on this day. And sure enough, the release of 4. So there it is. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. It's been really enjoyable.
My pleasure, Rob. You're a great interviewer. I've enjoyed myself.